You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt. Welcome to Bookworm. We're here for the second week with Anne Beattie, whose new novel, Picturing Will, has just been published by Random House. It's no secret to listeners of the show that I am a big fan of Anne Beattie and lucky also to be a friend, and it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You've been accused of being a witch by someone who says that you have an uncanny eye and that you remember things years after they've occurred in greater detail than you remember them immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Absolutely true, yes. I think one of the things that interests me so much about writing is that something will suddenly occur to me as I'm in the process of sitting there at the typewriter doing these stories, and it'll be absolutely vivid. I mean, just there, starkly. And it's never anything very momentous. It's not like it really was a dramatic incident or an inherently dramatic thing that I saw. But it will be there as though I could reach out and touch it and put it in there. And if I hadn't invented a new context, I don't think I would ever have remembered. I would never have plucked it out of the subconscious or wherever those things come from.
I once told you that I had loved an ashtray with cherry pits in it in a particular story, and you answered that while that ashtray was good, the real thing in the story was the white garden hose.
I remember that story, yeah, playback.
And you had said that it was only afterwards that going through in your mind that you located that hose as being the odd thing in that environment that you'd spent an afternoon in.
Exactly. I really had not articulated to myself what was wrong. It was a person who is a friend of mine who had a country house, and I was trying not to understand certain things about him at the time. And really, yes, the garden hose just sort of came back. I mean, it could have lassoed me while I was writing the story, you know, or grabbed me around the neck and just pulled me away from the typewriter or something, but I typed out without reflecting, really, that I was doing it, certainly with the unconscious working and the conscious not working, that it was the East Hampton equivalent of the snake in the grass.
Yes, that snake.
And once I realized that he had created a false Garden of Eden, I was horrified to have that revelation about the person. But for literary purposes, it worked quite pleasantly.
It amuses me. I think that sometimes you land on those things, like the snake. I know that I heard one story once that I haven't seen published, in which the snake becomes a huge inflatable toy. And there's a tree being, I think, chopped down in the story. And there, in that story, you had made a kind of crazy combination between George Washington and the cherry tree and the Garden of Eden again, mm-hmm. with toy snake. Does that happen just in the process of composing?
No, but it happens sometimes in the process of revising. I mean, often I go through these things, I think, as though I'm just an objective critic of them once they're there, and then I connect the dots. I put in one extra dot or I take out a dot, but there's a pattern there without having articulated that to myself, even in the process of writing it.
Something like a white hose, do you have a color memory? Is that... Because certainly the novel, Picturing Will, is very vividly colored. And I always find that there's an odd ability to remember a sense memory of things. I've often, when people would ask me, I often compared you to Fitzgerald because it seemed to me that, like Fitzgerald, certain qualities of light and certain colors come very crisply present in the prose.
Mm-hmm.
Any impulse toward painting or, you know, color arranging?
Well, I'll tell you, an absolute dislike in most cases of even color photographs. I'm one of those few people who still goes on vacation and has to go out and search the stores for black and white film. But who knows? It doesn't seem to me that anything is really striking me any more unusually than it would strike anybody else when I'm out there walking around that real world that's out there. It is true that when I recall things, they do tend to pop up in a stronger form than the way I experienced them at the time. You know, I spend a lot of time with visual people. I have friends who are photographers. I'm married to a painter. That's all of great interest to me, and it's kind of interesting to watch those people and know that they're watching the stoplight not to see if it turns green, but because they're so interested in its proximity to the tree, and they're thinking about depth of field. You really can see the wheels clicking sometimes, you know. But as far as I'm concerned, it's not ever at a conscious level that I'm looking at the world for its detail or that I'm making those assessments while I'm sitting in the car.
Do you find yourself in cars nowadays much?
Yeah, I do find myself in cars. Why do you mention that, Michael?
Oh, because I missed cars in your stories for a couple of years when you were living in the city, and cars seemed to be a thing you had to get to the country to see.
I thought you were going to kid me. This month's Vanity Fair has an interview. It is an interview with me. Vanity Fair, you know, sometimes gives people a car for a week, and then they come down and they do an interview with you to see what you thought of it. And much to my friend's endless amusement, they dropped off a $48,000 car that I had for a week, and then they broke my heart and took it away, but I've taken a lot of kidding about that.
I know. I think I had a message on my phone machine from you in that car, and I thought, Ann Beatty, aren't you something?
Tooling around a borrowed $48,000 car.
Well, the magazines will let you do anything.
Well, I think also it's their particular sense of humor in some way with that column. It's a very, I think, good writer named Mark Ginsberg who writes it. They don't exactly give you a car that is to the manor born. You know, they had Spike Lee driving around the Volvo 760, for instance. So I imagine that it was sort of tongue-in-cheek that they dropped off this incredibly expensive cruise mobile at my door.
In picturing Will Havabod, who is the gallery owner and sort of eminence grise of the
novel. Very grise. Noir.
comes from a very sophisticated world. And when I was first reading the novel, I think in manuscript, I suddenly became frightened of the Ann Beatty who knew his world. Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
As if to write him, you had to have been around at least a certain kind of shady and wild sophistication that I didn't associate with you at all. Another bit of witchiness, I guess, to get that scene down. But with a husband who's a painter and access to that by now hilarious world of galleries and accelerating art prices, do you find yourself that... tending toward satire? That book, that part of the book at any rate, seems hilariously funny to me.
I don't think it could tend any other way but satire. I mean, I think it almost writes itself, you know. It would be very hard to take the opposite viewpoint about some of that stuff. In point of fact, let me tell you that nothing would strike terror into my soul more than having to sit down for an evening's dinner with Havabud.
But I think you know him. He's appeared in several of your stories.
Well, you know, again, he's prototypical in some ways, just that in that he's a person who's really wildly out of control, and you think that what you see on the surface is out of control enough that maybe you're even a little dazzled by what you're observing and amused by what you're observing. Of course, what one tends to forget is that there's a dark side to all that stuff.
The novel Picturing Will is about the raising of a child who, at a certain point, becomes, what would you say, in the same way that a photographer witnesses events that he or she doesn't take part in, this boy witnesses events that he doesn't take part in, but that stain him.
Mm-hmm.
In one case, it's, would you call it? I don't think it's really child molestation exactly, since it seems so gleefully participatory. And in another case, it's the boy's father being arrested by the police and led away. The novel's events seem to revolve around those two events, both of them kind of horrifying. And yet my guess was that they were not plan. They arrived in the book at a certain point. What was your response when you found yourself having a child molester at the center of your novel?
Well, I guess I had realized, as I was saying earlier, that that's exactly the sort of person who might go out of control. In that specific way, it was a surprise to me. I didn't know things would take exactly the turn that they took. I just felt like I had to relentlessly follow them once they started turning out that way. He was a surprise. I admit he was a surprise.
It did strike me, in terms of the originality of this particular book, that, like some of David Sally's canvases, it felt like a triptych in which things were being...
Michael, you're unbelievable. My working title for this was Triptych.
No.
Couldn't have known that. I know you didn't know that.
I didn't know
that.
What was that?
Well, see, I was thinking about, you know, three-panel paintings, and I was thinking about, you know, figurative painters, and I was thinking about how you do get a view of the world by sometimes looking at things horizontally, really. I mean, that's what's happening with these paintings. You're reading from left to right, and you are looking at them as horizontal entities. You know, the sky is always above you, the gallery floor is below you. There they are. And I was trying to do a kind of parallel action in this book.
It is kind of amazing because, of course, what you see will always be eventually connected by the mind. And so it seemed to me that certain objects or moments or scenes were presented and then correlated together. A story was told about these very disparate things. And it's as if my guess is that in the rewriting, the book became more and more coherent so that it was simultaneously an art novel, an avant-garde novel, but also a novel with a considerable depth of character and story that you may not have anticipated at first.
Not only didn't anticipate, but it was really like sinking in quicksand and looking at every grain as I was going down. And once I set up the system, it took on a maniacal life of its own. Which was wonderful in some ways, and obviously at least difficult for me to rein in and deal with in others so that I wouldn't just lavishly be talking about everything, you know, which was not to the point at all. But I do think that you could look at any section of the book and think that it would be possible to have told the story with either section 1, 2, or 3 being the beginning section. It would have been a different book, but I don't think that there's any ultimate order to how these things are revealed in that book. And, of course, what was happening, again, with the structure was echoing, in some ways, what I assumed to be true of Will's mind. You know, when you're a little kid, if you only know a few things, you shuffle them together, and that's how you make sense. And any adult is very amused by that notion because the child is putting together totally discordant things simply because it's all that the child knows. It's all that, you know, he or she has experienced, and that's the only way it can be to the child. Similarly, though, I mean, you can think about the larger structure of the work and see that's going on here.
Yes, especially in that section where the boy is imagining shrimps battling lobsters who are measured according to the size of their heads.
Yes.
And the great joy of a boy who doesn't like toys put in the wrong place in the toy box, species who don't belong together. And I guess I particularly liked knowing that Will, the little boy, knew that Bugs Bunny should not go in the suitcase with G.I. Joe, but so did his stepfather, Mel, recognize in his little note on child raising that you would not put the wrong animals together.
Yes.
Mel seems to be the ideally loving parent, and, you know, in a way, I thought of two things. I always used to think when I was a child, I used to write things down in what I called the Book of Hurt Children, in which I would write down things that a parent should never, ever, ever do. Mel keeps a journal in this of things, of sensitivities that almost seem unearthly, things that he knows about raising a child. And it does come to seem that his love for Jody is oblique. He loves her through the child,
yes.
Through Will.
Yes.
How were those sections composed? They're so beautiful.
Well, first I had to have a clear idea of who Mel was, and of course I wanted to reveal him finally to be a different person than the person you anticipated even he would become. In their own rights, the sections might be actually quite romantic and good in any number of ways. They're good as prose, though, and there's something that he's written down. Then again, there's that whole world out there in which Will is being taken care of by these people, and as Will himself questions at the end of the book, maybe this was a little bit too much narcissistic romanticism in writing this instead of, you know, being the ultimate parent.
I thought I'd ask you to read part of that section because it does seem to me to be so beautiful and strange in its tone. This is from Picturing Will, and is a section about raising children that intrudes quite suddenly into the book, and it is not identified whose thoughts these are until almost the novel's last page. This is Ann Beatty reading from Picturing Will.
Of course you do not want the child to be a ventriloquist dummy, but if there could be a bit more sitting on the knee, a little less of the back of the head and more of the profile as you spoke, that might be all the better. The child that reminds you of your own mortality needs so much tending to, so many wisps of hair brushed off the forehead, so many dollar bills handed out, so many anklet cuffs turned down, so much humming to accompany the soprano sung solo, that it is almost impossible to decide whether to be as quick-talking as an escaped convict or as patient as a penitent. It is understandable that parents play a little game of self-deception and think they know everything about their child, that with their peripheral vision and with their ear inched backward an extra bit to listen, they need not turn to see the child's predictable expression, the gleeful smile, the lowered eyes. In this way, they miss the unexpected. They make the mistake of thinking children are simpler than they, and that therefore they have children figured out. The children know better. They know that at least some of the time they can rush toward danger faster than their parents can stop them, that the parent who confiscates the water gun has failed to notice the slingshot in the back pocket, that tying shoelaces is a reassuring activity for parents, that off-key bedtime singing should be tolerated because it helps parents unwind. You have created the child, but you could not have anticipated the child's power. Because the child's presence and desires are so constant, it becomes the course of least possible pain to persuade yourself that being subsumed is synonymous with parenthood. You can only pray that by early evening the child's eyelids will grow heavy with sleep. Then you hope that the sleeping child will not loom large in your own dreams, that once the nightlight has been switched on, that beam of light alone may guide the child to dreamland.
Ann Beatty reading from her new novel, Picturing Will, just published by Random House. This brings me to the subject of fairy tales. I read that at one point that there were fairy tales in the book, and I know that somewhere between the last book and now, you wrote a children's book called, I think, The Magic Spectacles.
Just Spectacles. Just called Spectacles, the book.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Well, they've probably reissued it called The Magic Spectacles, and you know about it, Michael, and I don't. That's probably these things have happened before.
What are your favorite fairy tales, or which children's stories did you most love?
Ooh, I liked a lot of them. Actually, I was particularly fond of a little golden book at the time called Bertram and the Ticklish Rhinoceros, which I think I refer to once in one of my stories, hoping that somebody else would write and say they were a great fan, and then I could write back and say, hey, do you still have a copy? Maybe there's a way I could get my hands on this. But I'm embarrassed to admit that when I think about things that I vividly remember, it's not, you know, necessarily something that would sound particularly cool, but I was very, very involved in Mary Poppins. Couldn't get enough of those. Went right from Mary Poppins to Nancy Drew.
What about Freddy the Pig?
Freddy the Pig, very good.
I just thought, maybe. Mary Poppins to Nancy Drew. The kids in most of your books are little boys. In Falling in Place, there are two central little boys. Mm-hmm. All of the children are boys in this book, all three of them. Any reason for an inclination to write boys' lives?
I think the truth of it may be is that when I was a little girl, I was very afraid of little boys. And, you know, I think as a writer that I have continued to think about things that seem mysterious to me. And not only do I think of men as the other, but, you know, the idea of little boys is somehow more interesting to me, less easy to understand in some ways, easier to explore as a writer because it seems less comprehensible to me than writing about a little girl.
I know that mystery is very important to you, and I think in certain ways that your answer to Flannery O'Connor's Mysteries and Manners is Secrets and Surprises. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I guess I just believe that there are always mysteries going on. I mean, it could probably be argued that I'm not a very intuitive person because any number of times in my life people have told me things point blank that have absolutely astonished me. It happens a lot. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I do think that everybody has secret lives, and part of my interest in writing Picturing Will was to partially expose those secret lives to the reader, but to have the reader question whether the people had even come to terms very much with their secret lives, or whether anything ever would make them come to terms with their secret lives. Everybody turns out to be a surprise, perhaps even to themselves. I would gather that it's perfectly possible that Half-A-Bud might not have succeeded, that he might have crashed in some way, that there might have been some sort of poetic justice at the very least. But all he does after all of his involvement and after the crisis of the book in some ways is go off to Paris and start merchandising performance artists. That happens all the time, too. You get away with all of it, I mean.
You seem to be the writer with supreme self-confidence and have at times taken people's breath away by being willing to tell people that you've done a draft of a book in 3 weeks, 4 weeks. This book was very different, took several years to write. What gave you the feeling that it was wrong? What brought you to redo and redo and redo this book?
I think it was overworked to some extent and that it seemed rather didactic. I think that it would have been easy to make one clear assessment of the characters and then perhaps even to have dismissed them, that I had to do things that were slightly more ambiguous, that were indicative of how things would turn out, but did not set the stage so that it was totally erroneous for the reader or, as I say, just set up characters that, once comprehensible, why would you continue reading about? That was part of it. And then also I do just think that in my mind there's so much anxiety associated with writing a novel that one of the ways I force myself to do it is to take a contract to do it. And then the next thing I do is to try to think of some almost Baroque system. Because if I don't know where the novel is going, at least I can know where my plans, you know, are going to take me. So I don't sit down having chapters outlined or even all the characters, but I have preconceived notions that sound dumb when stated, such as, I'm now going to write a lot of prose. I'm tired of having things unfold because of dialogue. You know, I'm now going to write introductory sections to the three parts of the book because I've never done that before. Well, I've never done it before, and I shouldn't have done it here. You know, so the book went through a lot of changes.
Who do you trust to let you know? Do you have readers?
Well, let's put it this way, Michael. I was quivering in my shoes until I sent this first draft to you, and you said it was all right. You were late in the process here. I had run it through about 8 people before that I was less afraid of than you, so as long as you ask, I'll just turn the tables here.
Oh, well, that was very embarrassing.
You'll recover.
When the book came in the mail and I read it immediately, I was thrilled because I've always believed that that there would be not a breakthrough book in the sense that people talk about GARP as a breakthrough book, but that there would be a book where there would be a success in form that would lead to others. And it seems to me that my level of excitement about what might be coming next is even higher than it had been before because of the pleasure that this book in its peculiarities and beauty and...
I'm going to write something even before I leave the studio, Michael, and give it to you on the way out so that you can continue to encourage me. This is wonderful. This is better and better. But I think actually in all of the books there's been not exactly a counter-narrative, but to some extent there's been a tacit admission that what you're reading is not the only story. You know, with Folly and Place, it came out, I think it was 80, that many years ago, at the end of the sections, of the chapters, I mean, they were italicized sections. And initially they started out in rough draft as being notes to myself of things I needed to later include. And then I realized, no, just let them stand. I mean, any chapter the reader reads will then have additional information or contrary information presented. And isn't that the way things are? I mean, at least it is the way I think things are. And I couldn't but be honest, you know, in asking somebody to read 300 or 400 pages, I couldn't put them on. I couldn't think, you know, to say, well, here's the world in 14 chapters or something.
You've mentioned that your concern is not with sociology, but with making sure that it's literature. When, sort of like the question, is it soup yet? When does it become literature?
Yeah, exactly. Well, in rough drafts, I always put a lot of things there because if I don't really put them there, I mean, if the moon isn't shining, I'll never think to have it shine as a way to show the characters, you know, their way through the forest. If it turns out that they don't get lost and they don't need the moon, I can go back and take it out. But somehow emotionally, it's necessary for me to put it there to know in every sense what that terrain is, so that then I can develop and build something. I at least try to step back and look at these things after they're done with a very harsh eye, and anything that seems to be a kind of motif that disappears or dissolves is either thrown out or extended. I mean, once those things are there, I can work with them, but I don't think I've ever looked at a book and thought, oh, I see how I can sort of inject this with whatever, humor, reason, symbol, anything.
Jules Renard, in his wonderful journals, at one point, he loves to write single sentences of advice to himself as a writer, and one of them is, put a little moon into what you write.
Is that true?
Yes, it's wonderful. Do you have anyone whose thought Valerie shows up in this book you go to that you find continually inspiring?
In a word, no. Any number of things strike me at the moment that I'm reading them, and in fact, I always think I'll remember them and want to remember them, but I'm always dazzled by people who can say, well, you know, as Proust said, you know, my eyes just, you know, I become the instant schoolgirl again. He said, what? Can I still learn that? But no, not in point of fact. Actually, the Valerie came not directly from the source, but was quoted in Auden's book, A Certain World. And I had had that on my bookshelves for 10 or 15 years and realized as I was writing this novel, and I have not looked at it once for those 10 or 15 years, that somewhere in there was something at the time that seemed absolutely shocking that he had quoted Valerie as saying. And I flipped through the book. It was quite an interruption. It took me about 6 hours to find it, but it was there. And it was just what I needed at that moment.
We've been talking to Ann Beattie, author most recently of Picturing Will, just published by Random House. It's a pleasure to see you here, and it's a great joy to have you across from me in the studio.
Thank you. I'm always in deep shock when I've written a novel.
This is Michael Silverblatt with Bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. This has been the end of a two-part interview with Ann Beattie, author of Picturing Will. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop.